The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming. And let me begin by thanking the Philadelphia Public Library and the folks at Penn Press for putting this together. It's interesting, I've served in three cities, and I think it's only fitting to kick off this book tour in the city of Philadelphia. Even though I spent a lot more time in New York, obviously, Philadelphia and Ed Rendell really gave me my start. People ask me, it really is the opening line of the book, that you always want to be a cop. And most chiefs will tell you, yes, from the time I was in grade school, that's all I ever wanted to be. Not in my case. I did not like police officers growing up in Washington Heights. As a matter of fact, I didn't like them when I was growing up in Dublin, Ireland, before I came to Washington Heights in 1961. They were like parents and teachers. They told you all the things you couldn't do. They arbitrarily took stickball bats from you on 175th Street, just because Miss Lemondrops was complaining that we were hitting the Spalding's against her window. And so didn't like police officers. However, a group of friends of mine that I grew up with, went to high school with, all took the police officers exam in 1967 and entered en masse to the NYPD. And while I didn't like being a police officer within 3-4 weeks at the most, that began what is up to this time a 40-year love affair with a profession that not only have I come to love and admire and brag about, but I've also been fortunate to live through some tumultuous times and seeing the process of change over those 40 years. I won't go into detail in the last chapter of the book, but it may be, from my opinion, the most important chapter. And I'll leave it up to you to read it, but it's a chapter on race and policing. There are three sections of the book, obviously, New York, Philadelphia, and Miami, but the issue of race and race and policing, you know, covers not just those three cities, but every city in America. And when you look back, when I came on as a young man in 1967, in the NYPD was a majority male white organization, and to see the transition over the next 30 or 40 years, not just in that department, but in departments across America, not, by the way, not willingly, but being pushed, shoved, and sometimes sued as a result of the grievances coming out of the 60s, the Vietnam protests, civil rights movement, etc. And so my favorite chapter is the last chapter because we've come such a far way. We have integrated police departments all across America. In fact, the Philadelphia Police Department, as far as reflecting the population it serves, is one of the leading departments in that area. And so when you look at the whole issue of integration, it strikes me as ironic that the two most conservative institutions in our society, the police and the military, have made the most progress in integration and getting a well-integrated workforce. But you'll read more in the chapter. The chapter concludes, interestingly enough, this year, one with the remarks made by a good friend of mine, Eric Holder. He was telling the truth, but he chose words that I probably wouldn't choose. Talked about this being a nation of cowards refusing or unwilling to discuss the issue of race. And he took a lot of flack for that. And I had a meeting privately in Washington with him, and I told him, you said the right thing. But he took such a beating, we wanted him to speak more on that, us at the Police Executive Research Forum, and he took a pass. But anyway, fast forward 4 months after that, we had a post-racial president and a post-racial society get involved in a racial incident referring to the Cambridge Police Department as having acted stupid in the arrest of Professor Gates. And so even the president, who had run a tremendous campaign staying above the fray, even he too got dragged into this issue of race, race in society. Finally, on the comment, it's interesting. When I was going to college in the early 70s, and for whatever reason, I took a weekend to read de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. It's a fantastic book written by a Frenchman in 1828, and he talks about this new American society and how great it is and all the opportunities, and he goes on and on and talks about how it's structured. And this is the new, if you will, the new nirvana. This is where it's happening. This is what the future looks like. There's one problem, though. He says the Achilles heel, if you will, of American society and the whole issue of race. And how would they deal with the issue of the races, the mixing of the races going forward? He thought pretty prophetically that that would be, and of course it did become an issue, certainly into the 20th century. But having been managed, I think, pretty well in the 60s and 70s, to today, you wouldn't recognize today what existed 40 years ago. But nonetheless, there's still some place to go, some more room for improvement, if you will. In any event, it is great to be here in Philadelphia. It's, as I said, Ed Rendell gave me my opportunity back in the beginning of 1998 when he hired me as the police commissioner on his final 2 years. And there was no expectation on my part that I would stay more than 2 years. Every mayor has the right to have his own police commissioner. And so my sense was I had a two-year window to institute the reforms I had in mind, and we went about that rather aggressively, dealing with a whole host of issues, most obvious, crime, but also issues of within the department on the reporting of crime. Those of you that are veteran readers of the Philadelphia Inquirer can remember the series. It must have gone on. Well, it felt like it went on for an eternity, but it actually went on for about a year and a half as they were striving for their Pulitzer Prize. They did a very good job of uncovering the deficiencies of the Philadelphia Police Department in reporting crime, especially in the area of sexual battery. And it was a tough time, and it's tough to be in an organization that feels like it's under assault. But nonetheless, we moved ahead and took a great deal of satisfaction in a Newsweek article some years later titled From National Disgrace to National Model. And while we made lots of changes in the area of deadly physical force and a whole host of things, I think I was most proud of how we went about fixing the sexual battery unit in the Philadelphia Police Department and really regaining the confidence of women in this community. Because there were, and the Philadelphia Inquirer outlined them in really graphic fashion, some outrageous cases. In any event, at the end of it, I put together a committee, because even though we'd made the changes, and Timoney said he made the changes, and therefore the changes were made, that wasn't enough. There were still issues of confidence. And so I established a team, or a group, a committee, if you will, made up mostly of lawyers, male and female. But I gave them the power that most committees, oversight committees, wouldn't have, because I thought it was so necessary at the time. And this committee served the function of reviewing the investigations of detectives. And they could say yay or nay. And if they didn't like the investigation or thought some more investigatory steps should be taken, they could bring it to the attention of the commanding officer of the sexual battery unit. And if they weren't satisfied with that, they could take it directly to me. And it's covered at great length in the book. But the reason I mentioned the story, when I got to Philadelphia, I kept hearing about it's a small town. It's a group of neighborhoods, and you get to know one. It's not going to be a small town. It's like 1.5, 1.6 million people. Well, it is. I was heading down this morning to do NPR, and I'm walking down Chestnut Street, just a regular morning, and I run into a woman, Tracy, and I'm drawing a blank on her last name, it'll come to me in a second, who has been a woman's advocate who, back then in 1998, was leading the charge, her and some other women, on reforming the Philadelphia Police Department. And she was a member of that committee that I established. And what often happens in policing, and I'm assuming it happens everywhere else, you put together a committee, they meet two or three times, and then it lacks energy, it lacks focus, and it just drifts. But talking to Tracy this morning, the committee is still in session. They still meet. They still do the oversight. And they've actually taken to the next step where they're involved with the Philadelphia Police Department in a really good partnership dealing with the whole issue of domestic violence. And so it was great to see something that was put in place a decade ago, 10 years ago, still up and running and functioning. So fair dues to Tracy and her colleagues. I go this morning, and so I do NPR, and it was like a trip down memory lane. It was fantastic. Lots of great questions, and then there were some people calling in, asking questions. Terrific day. I happened to mention my favorite topic, police unions and the arbitration system here, and going on that typical Timoney tirade. And so I'm leaving, and I'm heading back now up Walnut Street, and I'm making a phone call. I'm going to be on Fox and Friends on Thursday morning, and I'm doing the final adjustments, and I have my feet up, and I'm writing down a phone number. I have my feet up against the wall, and this gentleman, hey, you're Timoney. And I look over, it's this African-American guy with beads. This little guy's like a hippie in the 60s. I said, okay, good, very good. I mean, he's not moving. He's staying there. Timoney, I'm saying, and I'm on the phone. And I keep looking. The guy, I said, obviously this guy's going to want to talk to you. So it takes me another 5 minutes to finish. The guy's waiting, God bless him. So I turn around, and I shake his hand, and he looks like a throwback to the 60s. He's got the beads, got the stuff. He said, I heard you on NPR. Terrific. I said, good for you. He said, I'm one of the arbitrators. I said, don't take it personal. It's only business. Thank you very much. But hell, the arbitrators I testify, they ordered three-piece suits. This guy got bees, looking real sharp, about my age. Obviously, he had not left the 60s, or he had his leftover clothes from the 60s. But anyway, just a funny story with how small, what a small town this is. The final thing I would like to mention, you all know Eddie Rendell. I love him dearly. And he's, for me, just a great American hero with a work ethic that nobody can top, with energy that nobody can match, with a temper that nobody wants. And so when Ed was in his last year, they do, and there may be some lawyers here, one of the requirements for lawyers is they get retrained and recertified. They've got to go to class once a year, once every 2 years. And I happened to be one of the teachers of that class, and so Rendell was there, all the top lawyers, David Cohen, at this session. We had it at some hotel, about 200 or 300 people. And even Ed went to the courses, you know. I think he spent most of his time outside in the cell phone. But nonetheless, he signed and he attended the courses. At the end of it, and that was like October, he was finishing up December 31st or whatever it was. And so he had like 3 months left. And the people that ran the course are the law department. And at the end of it, the end of the week, they've been going for 5 days. They want to make a special presentation. So I happen to be up on the dais anyway with the city solicitor. And they have a few presents for Eddie. To thank him, you know, because they work with him in the law department, their fellow lawyers, all this kindred spirits. So I figured Eddie would be appreciative. No, he starts from back here screaming, get rid of those presents! And he barrels his only Eddie can up over it, and he takes on like, oh, God, here we go. What did we do wrong now? Put the presents away. We still have 3 more months to go. I'm not a lame duck. And he looks at me, John, I'm holding. You make sure they know I'm not a lame duck. We are working right up to the very end. I said, yes, Mr. Mayor. And he did. He had us. He drove us right up. And as a matter of fact, his last day, he went to a meeting every hour for 24 hours in typical Ed fashion. I say that only to get me to Miami, where I spent the last 7 years working for Mayor Diaz, a fantastic leader, much in the image of Eddie Rendell, although not as boisterous, probably more shy. more circumspect, but also a lawyer. And Manny was coming up, Mayor Manny was coming up in his last year, and I told him, you've got to use the Rendell model. As Eddie said, if you allowed him to treat you like a lame duck, you're a lame duck. You can't, and so I said, you can't allow him to treat you like a lame duck. People are going to start looking, you know, it's the old expression in policing. Who's your favorite chief? The next one. You can't allow that to happen in the mayoral campaigns, right? And so you need them to focus. You need the government to focus in. There may be campaigns going on, but if you're a term-limited mayor in your last year, you need to focus. And so for many years, he was the mayor of Miami, but almost as important, he was also head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And we had an election year coming up in 2008. And maybe for the first time under his leadership, we could get the people in Washington to finally start taking a look at an urban agenda. You know, our vision had been taken over to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we kind of lost the focus on urban America. And so Manny was determined to make sure that he got it back on the front burner. And as a result of that, he made sure that the people at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the staff people, will be working their tails off. And he did. And they, you know, God bless them. I know them all. But the staff people are like other staff people. And the problem with the U.S. Conference of Mayors is that you're only the president for a year. So they're always, who's your favorite U.S. Conference of Mayors president? The next one. So everybody's always looking forward, not getting much done. And Manny was having none of that. He was using the Ed Rendell model. He used it in the city of Miami, but also in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and was able, with the assistance, it was interesting. There were five broad categories, and I go through them in the book, that Manny wanted to cover. The number one issue being crime, the urban agenda on crime, and the cops program. And we kicked it off, rightfully so, in Philadelphia, where Mayor Michael Nutter hosted that meeting in Center City, and Joe Biden showed up. He wasn't the nominated vice president yet. He was coming up as Senator Biden, the former candidate, but he was coming up speaking on behalf of the nominee Barack Obama. And it was interesting, the same invite had been extended to the McCain campaign, and some staffer showed up. But in any event, Biden came in with certain promises, and he says these were not wild promises, these were not empty promises, that there was going to be a restoration of funding for the cops office, a reinvigoration of the cops office. And they took office on, I believe it was January 10th or January 20th. And 6 weeks later, Joe Biden came down to Miami to hold a press conference with money from Washington for the city of Miami for hiring additional police officers. So in that regard, what Manny Diaz, using the Eddie Rendell model of not easing on the gas pedal your final year, not relaxing, but in fact pressing down harder on the gas, not just on the city workers in Miami, but the folks at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, they were able to get the administration not just to listen, but to incorporate their recommendations in five major areas that they came up with. One, obviously the crime one, the whole issue of infrastructure that was headed up by Ed Rendell and Mike Bloomberg, the arts and culture by Vera Gosa, the whole issue of unemployment and jobs and the economy by Dick Daley, and I forget the fifth one, all things green, and I forget what city we handled it in. But in any event, I think it proved that the Rendell model works, that, you know, you get criticized for putting pressure on people, but sometimes, especially in government, you need to do it. You need to get people need to be reminded that at the end of the day, you know, you're working for the public, whether it's as a police officer or a teacher or a sanitation worker cleaning the streets or a garbage collector. You work for the people. And politicians and mayors and city administrators need to keep that in mind and keep the pressure off. You'll hear complaints from the unions that there's too much pressure, that in the area of police departments, that there's so much pressure that they're trying to doctor the crime statistics. That charge, that allegation, has been made in city after city as mayors try and deal with the issue of crime and quality of life in a serious fashion. some mayors back off. My advice is not to back off. So long as you're doing nothing illegal, there is no problem with not putting pressure or undue pressure, but there's no problem with holding people accountable. When I go to community meetings, when I went to community meetings here in Philadelphia, I was certainly held accountable by the woman who was screaming at me from the audience about drug dealers on the corner and your cops doing nothing, just driving by when we call 911. And so if I'm held under pressure from the general public and from politicians and everybody else that wants to take a whack, and by the way, rightfully so, then so too the police officers and their supervisors need to be held accountable for what they do. I think in Philadelphia we had a fantastic run in the area of crime reduction, of the reduction in police shootings, but also in a better trained police department, a more humane police department. Wasn't perfect, but every day we tried as much as possible to make it better. The final thing, it's interesting. I know I'm going to be accused of taking a whack at the press again. So I knew I was going to be making certain changes in the Philadelphia Police Department, and I was going to be dependent upon, if I said the changes are happening, it's the tree falling in the forest. We really needed, not as a partner, but as an independent observer, the press out there telling the story, good or bad. But I knew it was a good news story. I knew what we were doing was right. I knew the hearts and minds were in the right place. I wasn't worried. And we did in Philadelphia what, even today, no other police department had done. CompStat meetings, which were held every Thursday morning at 7 a.m. sharp at the Philadelphia Police Academy, was open to the public and was open to the press. And it worked out actually to our benefit, because by and large, we had the cops doing the right thing, working their tails off, the detectives doing their investigations, and the press was there to report it, and KYW, Tony Hansen, was doing fantastic because he could interview these homicide commanders and robbery commanders on the breaks, and he would be able to put out three or four stories over the weekend, all going to, enhance the public image and the public confidence of the police department. It was an important role for the press. And while I was there, they attended on a regular basis. But then when I left, I said, no, Timothy, why is it 7 o'clock in the morning? Can't you make it like 11, 11:30? And I think some of their interest may have waned. It's also, and this is not just the press here in Philadelphia, it's across the nation. And for an avid newspaper reader like me, who has on a regular occasion gone fencing and sword fighting with the members of the Fourth Estate, the notion of newspapers no longer existing or going out of existence, it's just troubling. I always look forward going back to Ireland, Dublin, small city, million people. They've got like 7 papers. And I get 3 or 4 of them, and I go to Bewley's coffee shop on Grafton Street, get my cup of coffee, and I just sit down there reading the Irish Times, the Independent. It's interesting. Some country like Ireland, a little country like Ireland, a little city like Dublin can produce 5 and 6 papers on a daily basis. And some of them have a morning and an afternoon edition. Just extraordinary. And then you see a place like Philadelphia, a great city, and other cities, down to two that are bankrupt. Places like Seattle losing papers, Pittsburgh losing papers, New York losing papers. It's just a shame. We need the press. We need the press. We despise them sometimes. They're a pain in the neck a lot of times. They always have these freedom of information requests. But we do need them. They're what keeps us on our toes. And I'm not sure. I'd love to know what it would look like 10, 20 years from now. I'm not sure. I don't think you'll have, like Mark Fazzola or Craig McCoy, the Inquirer, you won't have people like that are working the Internet somehow bothering you and asking you all sorts of questions. And that's not good. That's not good. I just don't know how it winds up later on. So I'm going to stop there. There's more in the book, but I think where we have a better opportunity is in some of the questions and answers I've asked. I've been told to be brief. I hope I didn't go too long. And I have my man here is going to direct you all the questions.
So I think you pretty much know the way this works. If you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic. This gentleman right here.
Welcome home, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. In your absence, the city has seemed to have backslid a bit in some terrible ways. Number one, I think you're aware of the fact that this city has become the most dangerous in the country to wear the badge, which is totally unacceptable. But number two, in terms of things like oversight and someone looking over the shoulders of the police, because they too are human, if you're aware of the Pulitzer Prize that the Daily News just got before
yes.
the sale,
yep.
it reveals a very unsavory episode in the history of the Philadelphia Police Department. What, and I know you don't want to second guess your friend Ramsey, but what would your suggestion be? And the mm-hmm. second question is, I know you're on a book tour, but where will you be on June 16th? I was talking to your friends at Finnegan's Wake, and they said they knew.
Well, I'll tell you what, I won't be at Finnegan's Wake. June 16th doesn't ring a bell. In any event, the issue of obviously the two women at the Daily News winning the Pulitzer Prize for uncovering a pretty nasty police scandal. You know, sometimes that goes with the business. 5 or 6 years ago, the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize investigating the Washington, D.C. Police Department involving police shootings. It kind of, I'll answer your question with just quick remark. Back in the olden days, in 1890, there were some bad articles about the New York City Police Department, and the chief was screaming and crying about the bad articles. And the editor of the local paper was Joseph Pulitzer, and he wanted to know, why do they keep writing bad articles about us all the time, this Pulitzer and his gang over there, wherever the paper was in New York? He said, here's the rule. Give me a bad story about a cop or a good story about a fireman that sells papers every day. Same logic applies. I'm not being too defensive. The issue here with Commissioner Ramsey, he is one of my best friends. He is in the top two or three police chiefs in America. He's got a proven track record in Chicago. When he took over Washington, D.C., that place was a mess. I mean, he was greeted with situations that I don't think any chief has ever dealt with. They had, in the prior 10 years, prior to him taking over, 54 police shootings where people were killed, and they could only find 27 of the records out of the 54. They were missing 50% of those records, the reason why the Washington Post got the Pulitzer. And so, yeah, there are bad stories, there are bad incidents, but I'm telling you, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better leader, smarter leader than Chuck Ramsey to handle it. And so, you know, I've been here a year and a half. He's done a fantastic job in the area of crime. I think as he goes forward with this department, and I know for a fact he's got other plans, this place will just get better and better. But the city is in very, very good hands with him. All the way back. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't say.
Yep, we can go all the way back. All the way back.
Commissioner, may I call you Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
I would like to ask you a question. If you had the opportunity, from your own experience, to determine how crime should be handled, how would you handle it? Because crime knows no color, no race, no creed. Crime is a situation that occurs when what I want is more important than what you have. I mean, I can do things untoward because it's to my benefit, not to yours. How would you solve this problem, no matter where you are, no matter what city? In other words, is there a way to put an end to crime, which has actually been something we've already had from man's beginning?
Difficult question, only because crime really is a personal and a very emotional issue. There's not enough time to go into all the steps, but suffice to say, at the end of the day, the public and the politicians have to hold the police department accountable, stuff I mentioned earlier. We've got to hold the police officers accountable that they're out there doing the job, but we also have to come up with overarching strategies on dealing with all crime. What's often not appreciated is this issue called quality of life crimes. And it was brought home to me on numerous occasions, but two specifically. One of them, when I first got here, I did two churches in West Philadelphia in the 19th District. And in both of those community meetings in the basement of a church, it was the same complaint. Drug dealers are on the corner. They're packing guns. Your cops are not doing anything. We call 911. They just drive by. I reach the conclusion, either they don't care, they're getting paid off, or they're in cahoots with drug dealers. You've got to make sure that the police officers are dealing with issues like that. But even lesser issues, things called quality of life, whether it's drinking beer in public, things of that nature. When I went to Miami, and so each city, they're no different. I went to Miami, and I met with a group of citizens from Overtown, and an older woman explained it more artfully than I ever could. She said, Overtown is a pretty depressed area, high unemployment, and all the ills that you would have in a tough urban area. She goes, just because we live in Overtown doesn't mean we don't deserve a good quality of life. And so I shouldn't have to wake up in the morning with heroin needles and all the indices of crack addiction right at my doorstep. And it's true. So police departments have to deal not just with the major crime, but also the quality of life crime. The final part, you know, I know it is a cliche, we can't do this alone, but the bottom line is we can't do this alone. And there's a need, especially in the tougher neighborhoods, for the community to organize, for the community to be partners with the police department, be the eyes and ears. I grew up in Washington Heights, in Upper Manhattan, tough area. I had an aunt who suffered from asthma and was always at the window 3 or 4 in the morning trying to get a breath of air. There are thousands of people like that in cities across America. There's always somebody looking out. And why wouldn't you recruit those people? Give me a plate number. Give me any kind of intelligence. But where the police departments have to come up big time is acting on the information they're getting. It's not an easy job. It's a very frustrating job in some respects. But it's going to take a variety of things, including some partnerships with the community. In those communities where it's the most difficult to be partners, because you may be viewed as being a snitch, working with the cops. In some respects, you could be accused of jeopardizing your own family by coming forward. Police departments have come to recognize that, and we have anonymous tip lines and a whole variety of other things. Difficult question.
Next, right in front here.
I'm curious. I'd like you to go back to the 1960s when you began to be a cop, right?
Yes.
And I was one of those revolutionaries that you all were kind of fighting. And I wondered what you were thinking as we presented to you the kinds of revolutionary ideas that have now taken force in our society, you know, the equalization of women, the battering of children, you know, gays and all of that. Yeah. Everything that we set out to present to you, and there you were as a young man on the other side, often with guns facing us.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder what you were thinking then.
Yeah. Well, truth be known, I wasn't actually too far off where you were coming from. And as a result, I was known as a bit of a whack job, bit of a radical, Timothy the commie, things of that nature. I had lovely red hair, longer than the average cop. In some parts of it, I was repulsed, and you accurately describe it. In other parts, I was very, very sympathetic. In other parts, and I can remember it, and I, I'm not, I'm not bragging. I'm just pointing out my feelings. And it's interesting that we just celebrated the killings of Kent State. And I remember being a young cop, and that, you know, I was ticked off for a whole variety of reasons, the Kent State. But it also proved, if nothing else, the whole idea of bringing the National Guard, that's the army, they're trained to kill. Cops aren't trained to kill. They may wind up having to kill, but they're not trained to kill. They're trained to protect and serve life. The military, the training is completely different. And so when you hear calls, and you hear it time and time again, whether it's at the border, in Chicago now there are two aldermen calling for the National Guard to be brought in because they're having some really serious crimes, that's not a good resolution of it. Finally, to get back to some of the radical notions coming out of the 60s, I remember in college reading Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, and I said, I got this. You do this stuff coming back at you all with humor, you know? And so I think I developed a sense of humor, trying not to be too thin-skinned, although I'm constantly being accused by the member of the media of he's very thin-skinned. You know, he can dish it out, but he can't take it. I can take it. You all can't take it. That's the problem. Finally, in a whole variety of areas, it wasn't that the police departments went willingly. It was as a result of lawsuits, particularly in the area. There may have been more dramatic change as a result of lawsuits in the area of domestic violence more than any other part of policing. When I was a young cop, it was pretty simple. You go to a family fight, you separate the combatants, and you take the guy for a walk. As a result of a whole series of lawsuits in the early 80s, police departments went into a completely different posture, including a mandatory arrest, which, of course, cops figured, oh, I understand. That means you got to do it. So they go in, they lock up both of them. So we had to go through a whole other training session. Hey, listen, knucklehead, it doesn't mean everybody gets arrested. That means the primary aggressor, who's usually the guy, gets locked up. And so we've gone through that, and there's been, I think, dramatic improvements in the service delivery of police departments in the area of domestic violence all across America, and I think in every police department. Here's the one caveat I offer, and the data is a little old. It's probably about, it was actually when I was in Philly, so it was probably about 8 years ago. So all these efforts in domestic violence were meant to get the man away from the scene, if you will, to prevent bodily injury and death in some cases. When they looked at the statistics after 10, 15 years of this, domestic violence homicides, as a proportion of all homicides, it's usually around 10 or 12%. After 15 years of great work on the part of police departments and courts and women's advocates, the whole bit, that percentage, that proportion of women victims had not decreased even slightly. What had decreased, it's interesting enough, was male victims, where the guy would get stabbed on a wife and she'd, no, you shouldn't be clapping, sir. It went down only because the women were taken to shelters and stuff like that and weren't forced in the opportunity where they had to defend themselves. Finally on that, I served on a commission with Jeanine Pirro, put together by Governor Pataki back in 1996, on domestic violence, where we traveled all over New York State. We had subpoena power, and we had a series of meetings, pretty powerful meetings, but the last meeting was the most powerful. It was at Bedford Correctional Facility, where we interviewed 10 women who had killed their spouse. And I'm telling you, and I'm not some weak-kneed liberal when it comes to locking people up. Four of those women had no right, should never have been in jail. I mean, you want to talk about... And as a result, we put together a petition to the governor, myself, Jeanine Pirro, and the commission, requesting clemency on the part of Pataki, which he did at the end of the year. So thank you for your question. You brought me back to the 60s. I wish I was still in the 60s in some cases.
Okay, on our left here on the aisle, gentlemen.
Welcome back to Philadelphia, Mr. Timoney.
Thank you, sir.
Good to see you.
Good to see
Thoroughly
you.
Enjoyed this. As you know, in all the papers, you know, it's the 25th anniversary of MOVE.
Yes, sir.
What would you say we've learned from MOVE?
You know, it's a fascinating question. The Inquirer on Sunday, I don't know who saw it, did a huge piece, Craig McCoy, pretty in-depth. And what I kept thinking is, you know, what an awful, awful time in this city. I'm not about to second-guess what happened, what people did then. What I can tell you, it was interesting. When I got here in 1998, some of the senior officials in the police department, these are tough guys, were clearly embarrassed and hurt by it, by that situation. So it wasn't that you had this this callous police department. It was just, you know, when something was wrong, it went terribly wrong. I thought McCoy's piece was pretty good. But it reminded me, in some ways, there was an issue when I was the chief of police, chief of department in New York. There was a boycott at a clothing store in on 125th Street in Harlem. And some crazed madman went in there with a gun and lighter fluid and lit it up and began shooting. And the place went up pretty fast. And I remember listening, it's terrific, to the 911 tapes, because one of the young men, he was like the security guard or manager in the place, had gone downstairs and was calling 911 on the payphone for help. There's a guy upstairs shooting. We can't get up. The place is in flames. But because of the shots fired, the fire department couldn't go in. The police department couldn't get there fast enough because there was fire going on. And it just, that incident reminded me. It wasn't clearly as graphic. There wasn't the numbers. There wasn't children involved in the 125th. But sometimes you get situations that happen like that. And it's just, it's kind of one of the horrors of policing. I'd be curious, you know, when I got here, John Street, when I was working for Mayor Rendell and Street, they were still faced with that issue of what to do with the homes on Osage Avenue. It's still an issue for this city, for the, you know, it's an indelible scar on the city's psyche. I don't think it's something you should ever forget. There are all sorts of lessons to be learned. Just a horrible situation. I mean, I can't comment on that more than that.
Time for a few more questions, right here in the fourth row.
Gun violence is the second leading cause of teenagers and second leading cause of death of teenagers in the United States, and the leading cause of death of minority teenagers in the United States. Do you have any ideas that better than anybody else's? Because our ideas aren't so great right now.
No, it really is a difficult issue, and it's, for whatever reason, the last 3 years in Chicago, it's become a bit of an epidemic. And so as a result, there are two city council persons calling for the National Guard to come in. Stupid request. When you look at gun and gun violence, and you look at homicides, every single year, Philadelphia, this lovely city here, leads the nation in the proportion of homicides with guns. It's usually around 83-84% of all the homicides are with guns. You go to places like New York City, 62-63. Pennsylvania is the second biggest gun state after Texas. You know, I have my master's, one of my master's degrees is in American history, and I remember studying about Pennsylvania, Ben Franklin, and quiet, peaceful Quakers. I kind of knew about it, but I didn't realize the extent of the gun issue in Pennsylvania, but specifically in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And on more than one occasion, myself and Bob McNeely, who was the chief of police in Pittsburgh, went up to Harrisburg, one time with Edwin Delbert, and he and I went up by ourselves, kind of pleading for some kind of relief. None was forthcoming. But to make matters worse, or worser, as they say in Brooklyn, the ability of, this is a Class A city. This is the biggest city in the Commonwealth. But the city can do nothing regards to governing the ownership and carrying of weapons. Basically, the law says unless somebody is a complete whack job, or they've been convicted of certain felonies, they can't be denied a pistol permit. And I'm the guy that signs them as the police commissioner here. In New York, to get a pistol permit, You'd need like a barrier of lawyers to get them. But here, I think I was the only guy not carrying a gun. It was just extraordinary. But here is the crazy part of it. So Brad Richmond, some of you may know Brad, worked for me. He was one of my lawyers. He's now at the Montgomery Attorney's Office prosecuting cases. But Brad handled all those issues for me. And we were trying to tighten up control of the permits. And I'll show you how silly it is. So one night, right over here at Hanneman Hospital, some guy shows up at the hospital, not feeling well. He's wrapped up in tin foil. He's got the antennas. And he wants to see a doctor. So they bring him in, they put him in the gurney, they start to unwrap the silver foil, and he's got a gun inside. A fully licensed pistol permit holder from the Philadelphia Police Department. So, of course, we confiscated it. We withdrew his right to carry. And then this guy was this was not some insubstantial, inconsequential citizen. He got a battery of lawyers, sued us, took us to court, because then he was, I guess he got his medication back and he was okay. And he's okay, he should be able to carry the gun. And I believe we lost that case. And so it's troubling that the police department, I mean, my point was, okay, if I can't control, what do you need my signature if it's meaningless? You know, you should get a signature where I approve of this. Well, no, I didn't approve of it. But the state legislature says, well, guess what? You can't disapprove of it, so just sign it and you approve of it. It's a very, very difficult situation. It's something that Eddie Rendell fought. It's fell on deaf ears. But there is a direct correlation with the proportion of gun homicides and the availability and easy access of guns. It's that simple. And all you got to do is look at the states, look at the cities, whether it's Boston, New York, which stricter gun control, if you will, and others that don't have it, and you'll see the proportions are different, and in some cases as high as 15%.
Chicago has strict gun control laws on the
drug
crime.
No, as a matter of fact, they're trying to get that. They've like the District of Columbia, they've had a few laws thrown out. There have been efforts to tighten them. They're in the process. Dick Daley's in the process of trying to create another law, but it's not happening.
Got time for one more lady about 10 rows back.
Could you give us your opinion of the appropriate use of the taser gun?
Listen, Lee, are you that anonymous female that called NPR today? I did, yes. I did an Irish jig this morning. I will do an Irish jig today. I'm not going to opine on other police departments. But here's what I will tell you on a serious note on the tasers. When I got to Miami, the day I was sworn in, 13 police officers were starting trial in federal court on a variety of federal charges surrounding so-called bad police shootings. We began the effort immediately of changing the guidelines, making really the most restrictive shooting guidelines in the nation, but also equipping our police officers with taser guns. And here's the interesting part. We went my first 20 months without a single bullet being discharged in Miami, a city that had huge problems over its history with police shootings. But when you look at police shootings, and by the way, this is for those taser people, I don't own stock. I actually don't even like the people that own the company, but it's a good product. When we gave them tasers, in downtown Miami and in Miami-Dade County, because of the weather, it's understandable, it has the highest proportion of mentally ill, disturbed people, street people, of any other county in the nation. Why? Because of the good weather. My first month there, I'm driving my bike down Biscayne Boulevard. There's a guy laying out on a sheet of paper. He goes, "Yo, commish!" So I call my mayor. I said, "I think we have a visitor from Philadelphia. He's down for the winter." And anyway, city after city, whether it's Eleanor Bumpers in New York, whether it's Window Washer Charlie here in Philadelphia, Margaret Mitchell in L.A., city after city, have cases after cases where police officers have been forced to use deadly physical force by people who are mentally ill, mentally disturbed, off the medication, often street people. And the average citizen, if you're a police chief and you say, listen, the two guys came out, they stuck up a bodega or a liquor store, and the cops shot and killed them, they say, hey, that's the cost of doing business. No problem. But when somebody who's mentally upset, who is at the, well, my mother would refer to as a poor soul, they can be dangerous, they can be violent, they can be threatening, they can be all those things, but very seldom are they carrying guns. But they can be carrying a bat, a knife, all those other things. In those situations, the weapon of a taser is perfect. It gives you enough distance, about 20 feet, and you can resolve those issues without resorting to deadly physical force. In my first year, there were at least three, where the individual would have been shot had we not had the tasers. So the taser weapon and weapons like that are great alternatives to deadly physical force if used properly, and you need to have very strict guidelines. When we did it in Miami, we had strict guidelines, and every once in a while the cops would push the envelope and you make them more strict. And so it's not a science, it's an art on how you kind of control the usage. But just because, and I'm not saying this is the case in Philadelphia, but because, and we had them in Miami, where a police officer didn't use his head while using the taser, doesn't mean you throw out the baby with the bathwater. That means you train that police officer. If necessary, you discipline that police officer. But the taser and other alternatives to deadly physical force are good. They work. They save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.